Coming up on Tech Nation, a full hour of Tech Nation Health. First up, Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft talks about the future of surgery and simply the future of intervention. Then Dr. Phil Lau, the director of the Purdue Center for Drug Discovery, tells us why it's so hard for surgeons to remove all the cancerous tissue and a technology that's looking to change that. Finally, Professor Richard Kuhn, who recently was the first to discover the structure of the Zika virus, compares Zika to other viruses like polio and HIV. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Sometimes you just have to feel for the police. The San Francisco Chronicle reported that a half-naked man allegedly resisted arrest by biting and attacking police trying to arrest him on a street in San Francisco's Mission District, where witnesses told officers he was running around throwing tree branches at random people. Minutes after the responding officer radioed for help, a police spokesman said that he was in a physical fight with the suspect, who tried to gouge out the officer's eye. This is not a scenario anyone would wish to deal with, and yet that wasn't what caught my attention. At the end of the piece was this. Police asked that anyone who took cell phone video of the incident call the investigation team. Well, we're a long way from Rodney King and a video camera, and not so long ago from Oscar Grant and the Fruitvale BART station, where the cell phone videos of bystanders definitively captured the irreversible actions of a transit officer. And now today, police are actually asking people for videos. To quote the police spokesman, the more video you have, the better to show what happened. A telephone number was provided to call in an anonymous report, and there was also a way to text in a tip anonymously. Just text it to TIP 411. I was reminded that several years back, a friend of mine was drinking his coffee and reading his morning paper, and read that two fellows had held up a store and stolen a car to get away. He got up and went to get his car out of the repair place when the two guys walked through the door and asked the counterman a question. These were the days before cell phones, and you had to find a landline and somehow figure out how to get through to the police and the right investigation team. It took the better part of an hour, and the fellows were long gone. In a day or two, they were caught. But think how differently it would all play out today. Everyone is always looking at their phone, and making a call is the exception. You're scanning email, surfing the net, reading texts and responding, playing games, bringing up apps. And if my friend had had one of today's phones, he could even have hit record, and no one would have been the wiser. All while he was just standing there. But it's bigger than that. Another item, this one from the Associated Press, reported that about one-third of the 18,000 police agencies in the U.S. either employ or are testing body cameras. But now laws and regulations about them are crawling in. Indiana has passed a law requiring any police agency actually taking video to store it for 190 days, or basically 6 months. This caused one small town to cancel their cameras. Their current 30-day storage policy cost about $5,000 to $10,000 per year. But 6 months would drive the price up to $50,000 to $100,000, at least in the first year. Well, that's understandable, except for the $50,000 to $100,000 price tag. Just for storage? Apparently, the department would have to buy new servers. That's right, new hardware. Well, if ever there was an application begging to store its data in the cloud, this is it. Yes, there's security and encryption and the like, but this problem can be solved, and cheaply. So let's do it. Make it a matter of when, not if. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, a full hour of Tech Nation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies. First up, Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft tells us about the future of surgery, or perhaps more simply, the future of intervention. Then Dr. Phil Lau, the director of the Purdue Center for Drug Discovery, tells us why it's so hard for surgeons to remove all the cancerous tissue, and a technology that's looking to change that. Finally, Purdue professor Richard Kuhn, the first to discover the structure of the Zika virus, compares Zika to other viruses like polio and HIV. Now, TechNation Health Chief Correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft. Well, Daniel, what do you got for us today?
Well, we've talked a lot on the show about maybe preventative care and health and wellness and lifespan, but folks still get disease, and I think that's not going to go away even with the magic of different technologies. So I thought we'd talk a bit about the future of intervention, everything from surgery to medicalized apps to treat disease and manage it once you have it. So let's start with traditional intervention, surgery. Everyone's familiar with surgery.
Oh, yeah.
That's a world that's really evolving in interesting ways. We still have to cut people open to take out tumors or manage a whole variety of medical issues. But we're trying to get less and less invasive. The idea is to be more precise, more personalized. And we're moving into a world of less invasive surgery. In the last 25 years, we're now seeing most surgeries move to laparoscopic. So it's relatively rare that you open up the whole belly, for example. Scopes going in that use pretty much traditional optics. What's happened in the last decade or so, you've seen groundbreaking companies like Intuitive Surgical bring us the world of robotic surgery. And it's not really the robot doing the surgery there. The surgeon can go basically and be in the same room usually, go inside a little terminal, see in 3D inside the patient through the camera, and manipulate the controllers and operate in a less invasive manner to take out a gallbladder or prostate. And right now, the surgeon is directly controlling the robot. That's being augmented and changing in that now, instead of just seeing, for example, the liver that you're trying to resect through the scope, we're starting to see innovation where you can layer in augmented and blended reality. So the surgeon sees from the CT scan where inside that liver the blood vessels are to avoid them or where the tumor is to try and take it out. So ways to augment the sort of situational awareness and make that surgery faster, less complicated. And other work where you can sort of paint with tumor paint, I think is the code word, to make fluorescent areas of where the tumor might be so that you can cut it out. There's always issues in surgery to leave no margins where the tumor or cancer might recur. So it's hard to see that in an open surgery or through a laparoscope. So ways to illuminate and highlight those areas. So there's a lot of sort of things that are blending together in robotic surgery. And with the sort of advent of artificial intelligence and machine learning, I think what we're going to start to see is the surgeon's going to be able to essentially press a button, draw a line, and the suturing will happen instead of having to do that by hand, which might be slower or less facile than a machine can do. Or we'll see the ability for guidance. We're seeing now this idea of almost a surgical coach can be watching you through the same camera that you are. They might be in New York and you're in San Francisco or you're mentoring a surgical case in Kathmandu. And you can have the help of the best surgeons in the world if you're getting in trouble or they're mentoring a medical student or a younger surgeon through a case to help that out. So this sort of ability to blend telehealth and surgery and AI is going to come together to really impact that field dramatically.
And not to mention the robots. Once you start to see how precise the robots can be, how repeatable they are, how steady they are, you say, oh my goodness, I've been trusting a human hand. I picked the robot.
Well, we fly all the time with robots. Our airlines today are essentially flying robots. The pilots there, I'm a pilot, I love flying. I talked to a pilot the other day who was an airline pilot. They spend very little time hand-flying the airplane. It's almost all pressing buttons, and the planes will essentially land themselves. Even in eye surgery, if you're getting corrective eye surgery, essentially the laser is set up. You press the button after the calculations are done, and it does the basic eye corrective surgery. So I don't think we're going to see robots replacing doctors and surgeons, but they're going to continually augment our skills, make procedures smarter, more personalized, more efficacious.
Driverless cars, we could have surgeonless surgeries? I don't think so.
Think about all those incredible technologies in driverless cars, from LiDAR to look at the mapping to knowing where the other roads cars are on the road. Many of those same technologies can overlap and converge in the surgical space. We have the same challenges with regulatory and who's going to pay for it. Things happen a little more slowly sometimes in the medical world than even with self-driving cars. But that's incredible technology we can apply to healthcare from a whole variety of spectrums. And I think, you know, we won't, especially in areas which don't have enough medical care, nurses, doctors, surgeons, and others, we'll start to be able to extend ourselves. I could go and port into a rural village and help a technician there do a complex surgery, or send in the drone to bring in the robot kit to do other elements that will augment our abilities.
What about people with chronic diseases that need constant medical attention?
Well, the classic case would be type 1 diabetes, where the patient themselves has to be doing for their entire life managing their insulin and their blood sugar levels. Diabetes is still a horrible disease, has lots of downstream implications for folks who don't control their blood sugar as well. It can go too low and they can go to coma and die. It can go too high and cause lots of issues. And we're starting to see innovation come from unexpected places. I just met yesterday with the founding team at Bigfoot Biomedical here in the Bay Area. It was started by a quant on Wall Street whose son developed type 1 diabetes. And so he ended up managing the blood sugar of his son. His wife, a physician, also had type 1 diabetes. And he knows data and how algorithms would help trade. He used that same knowledge to go, could I hack a continuous blood sugar monitor, glucometer, and connect that through software he designed to the insulin pump, which used to have to be programmed by hand, still is, and have now shown that they've had hundreds of folks, not in the traditional FDA model, able to now computationally and algorithmically manage their blood sugar sort of hands-free. Now they formed a company to bring that all the way through very complicated, expensive clinical trials. And I think in a couple of years, we'll see the field of how type 1 diabetes is managed with these sort of smart, connected artificial pancreases, which is partly designed by the leads are folks outside of healthcare, combined with their CEO as the head of the JDRF, who was also son, had type 1 diabetes. So we're seeing new mindsets come in managing chronic disease. And that's blending, you know, cheap sensors, mobile apps, big data, and artificial intelligence so that the algorithm for every diabetic patient keeps tuning and optimizing to their activity, to their diet, to their genomics. Tremendous opportunity. And that's a bit of an example of digiceuticals, the idea that we're not just going to prescribe a drug like insulin or a medical device like a knee brace or a stent. They're going to be coming sometimes with digital wrappers. So I might prescribe you, for example, a kid might have scoliosis. You can have a wearable scoliosis brace today. They're pretty kludgy. They're made by hand. Now you can use your smartphone to scan the patient and then 3D print a scoliosis brace that matches that patient's anatomy and even put their favorite Disney character on there and add in sensors to track when that patient's wearing it and add gamification layers. So you can make that young adolescent woman who doesn't normally want to wear it and get rewarded for it. So there's a company here in San Francisco called Unique, even partnering with Intel to do the sensors to 3D print personalized elements. That's a bit of a digiceutical meets a medical device. Then there's just digiceuticals that are just an app for behavior change. Omada Health here in San Francisco has a behavior change platform to take folks who are almost type 2 diabetics or pre-diabetic, put them in a social network, give them a connected scale, wearable device, and using behavioral elements and tracking data, really tune folks to change their behaviors and not become expensive type 2 diabetics. So that's a bit of a prescribable digiceutical that's now FDA approved or being paid for by Medicare.
Is there any way we can avoid these surgeries or invasive procedures?
Yeah, as we get to be less and less invasive, we want to avoid the need to open up the body, take out the tumor, sew things back together. There's a lot of things that aren't surgically approachable, like metastatic lung tumors or tumors that might be in the liver or uterine fibroids that could be approached. And one really interesting technology that's come together is what's called MR-guided focused ultrasound. So you know ultrasound for looking at hearts and babies. It turns out if you focus beams of ultrasound, you can heat up a small area. It's applied focus energy. And that can now heat up, for example, a uterine fibroid and knock that out in a woman, and she'll never have to have an actual open surgery. Or if someone has metastatic disease to the liver that couldn't be operated on because there's too many, you could, while the patient's in an MRI scanner, moving and breathing, focus at ultrasound, timing the movement of the breath and focusing and zapping out, essentially burning those burning out those spots. And even for things like Parkinson's, where there's areas of the brain that you might be able to hit with a beam of focus energy that knock out the tremor area, you could go into the scanner with a tremor and come out after MR-guided focus ultrasound. And those are in trials and showing efficacy as well. So really interesting ways to apply energy in the body. Obviously, there's folks looking at antibody-based approaches to deliver chemotherapy and other realms across the spectrum. But we want to move to an area where we pick up disease super early and can treat it in the least effective, and the most effective, least expensive, and less invasive way. And we're seeing technologies move in that direction.
I like the idea that you don't have to open me up.
No one wants to be opened up. That avoids a whole slew of complications. And as I mentioned, surgeries are getting less invasive, and people are going to what used to be a week in a hospital for hip implant or total knee replacement, you're an outpatient surgery. My field of bone marrow transplantation, we're doing essentially outpatient bone marrow transplants where someone comes in and gets the infusion of stem cells and leaves the same or next day, and we can monitor them at home using connected devices, using their smart homes, using a digital thermometer to track them and bring them in back to the hospital setting if they need more intensive monitoring or therapy.
But only if they need it.
That's only great. If they need it, because no one wants to be in the hospital, and it's actually a dangerous place to be.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Maura.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is chief correspondent for TechNation Health and founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. For many cancers, lung, breast, kidney included, cancer patients undergo surgery to remove the cancerous tissue, hopefully all the cancerous tissue. I asked Dr. Phil Lau, a distinguished professor of chemistry at Purdue University and director of the Purdue Center for Drug Discovery, why is that so hard?
The reason why finding all the cancer is very difficult is that frequently the cancer metastasizes to different distant locations, and those distant sites are difficult to find and to resect. Sometimes some metastases occur locally, in which case when you look at the main tumor mass, it's possible to find the adjacent lesions also. But more importantly, a cancer cell is very similar to a normal cell, and it expresses or it contains virtually all of the same proteins. It contains a lot of the same metabolites and other components. The visual distinction between a cancer cell and a healthy cell is often very small and difficult to discern. And so the surgeon is left to try to identify any malignant lesions by two different tools, and that is the use of their eyes to see if there's any change in coloration or appearance. Maybe it sticks out or it protrudes. Or alternatively, with their hands, they feel the tumor, and it's often a lot harder. It's more solid, but not invariably. The problem is that many of the malignant lesions are not easily detected by either of these tactile or visual methods, and so they go unidentified. And as you probably well know, a substantial fraction of breast cancers recur at the site of the surgery. I think it's up to 40%, depending on the hospital. In ovarian cancer, the surgery very frequently recurs in the peritoneal cavity where it spreads. And often the lesions that cause this recurrence are smaller than a millimeter in diameter. And so identifying these is virtually impossible without the aid of some sort of a visual contrast agent.
So how is it we can enable surgeons to do better surgery?
Okay, well, what we do is we look for a difference between cancer cells and normal cells. This difference is very frequently a protein that might be present on the surface of a cancer cell but absent from the surface of a healthy or a normal cell. We then design a homing molecule. We call it a targeting ligand that homes in very specifically on this different protein that is different on the cancer cell from the healthy cell. And we simply use that homing molecule as a smart bomb. We attach a very bright near-infrared fluorescent dye to it. And when that conjugate of the homing molecule and the dye is injected into a cancer patient, it circulates throughout the body but only attaches to cancer cells. And as a consequence, the cancer cells glow like a bright light bulb when you turn on the fluorescent lamp, and the healthy cells remain dark. And the surgeon then, once he turns on the fluorescent lamp, can very easily see these malignant lesions and even identify some as small as 2 or 3 cells in a single cluster. We've shown in some of our clinical studies in ovarian cancer patients, cancer lesions as small as 2 or 3 cells can be identified and resected. The challenge here is actually to find homing molecules that are capable of recognizing all different kinds of cancer. And so we have focused over the last few years on developing these tumor-targeting molecules or these homing molecules for all human cancers. And we believe now that we can safely cover 90 to 95% of all malignant disease in humans. So we have these linked to bright fluorescent dyes, and the resulting molecules are capable of lighting up virtually all human cancers.
Now, I'm familiar with how you get a new drug past the FDA or how you get a medical device approved. Mm-hmm. How do you get this complicated relationship of dyes attached to homing modules that get to the cells and light up, and then we can do the surgery? How do you get that all approved?
Well, Moira, the approval process is often difficult and filled with obstacles and minefields. But in essence, what we have to do is demonstrate that the molecule that images the tumor is both safe and effective. And we, in order to take the molecule into humans, we have to evaluate its safety and efficacy in numerous animal models first. We did that. It proved to be very safe and effective. Then we took it into humans. And to date, the only adverse events that we've seen are very minor allergic reactions. Some patients seem to experience some nausea or something of this sort. It's actually well treated with a Benadryl pill. And so that's
really?
Basically all they have to do is take a Benadryl, and that assures that these...
That's my kind of side effect.
Yeah, they're very mild. And then the efficacy, we have to demonstrate that it indeed reveals additional cancer tissue that the surgeon would not have seen otherwise. And to do this, one of the ways that we have conducted the clinical trial is to have the surgeon go in and remove all the malignant disease that he or she can see with the naked eye and by touch, by palpation. And then after he or she is finished with the surgery, they turn on the fluorescent light and they see what they've missed. And in the vast majority of cases, they have missed some disease that would have otherwise grown back and caused a recurrence of the cancer. So, from our perspective, cancer is a very heterogeneous and difficult disease to cure. But if you can cut it all out, then there isn't any disease left to recur, and that's the best solution to the problem. So improving surgery to enable the surgeon to be able to see and resect all malignant disease is probably the best solution to treating cancer.
Now, you're in studies now. Where are those going on?
The clinical trials for the early phase studies, phase 1 and phase 2, occurred primarily at the University of Pennsylvania Medical Center in Philadelphia, at the University of Leiden Medical Center in the Netherlands, at Moffitt Cancer Center, at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and at the University of California at Irvine. We're now expanding to include sites at MD Anderson, at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and some other major cancer centers.
All the usual suspects.
Well, we would like very much to have our drug tested and evaluated, in some cases perhaps optimized at the best cancer centers in the country. I forgot, we also have a trial going out on at Indiana University Medical Center in Indianapolis.
Close by.
Yeah.
Close by. Yes.
Our partners.
Your partners yeah. In this. These are early days yet. This is like you're really studying this. Sounds like this could really change how cancer surgery is done.
Yeah, I think if you speak with the surgeons that have participated in these trials today.
The first time the light goes on.
The first letters we get back from them or emails are always very excited and very enthusiastic, and they continue to be, but it's quite an enlightening experience, no pun intended, for these surgeons, because it enables them to see a lot of disease they couldn't have otherwise found, and it's very exciting. I think most of them agree that this technology, whether it's from our group or from some other group, will change the practice of surgery in the future. I think 10 years from now, you won't see any surgeries being conducted without these tumor-targeted fluorescent dyes. And if I can add, I believe it's not simply going to be used for visualizing tumor tissue, but right now, for example, we're working on a different color of near-infrared dye that will image nerves, and still a different color that will image ureters and bile ducts and other essential structures that sometimes get severed and lead to serious morbidities. For example, if a prostate cancer patient goes in for surgery and one of the nerves innervating the prostate is accidentally severed, that patient can become incontinent or impotent. And the same goes for severing a ureter. With that opening in the ureter, the urine would naturally drain into the peritoneal cavity. And so the surgeon, if they accidentally cut it, has to spend the time re-ligating that ureter back together before they can end the surgery.
And they may not know it.
They may not know it in some cases, exactly. And I've watched, and these ureters are often buried underneath a lot of other tissue. And so what we're doing is putting in a near-infrared dye so that they light up a different color from the cancer. So when they shine the light, one will appear one color. Hopefully it someday may be, you know, surgery by colors.
Yes, it's a whole different idea.
It's a different idea.
How to do surgery.
Yeah. But anyway, I think it will definitely change the practice of surgery.
How many of these procedures do you have to do for this to become completely accepted?
Well, I think the requirement is that we show a statistically significant benefit. And this will depend on the cancer type. For example, in ovarian cancer, it's very common for the cancer to spread, in some cases, like sands of the sea throughout the peritoneal cavity. And so the difference between the lesions that the surgeon can see without the aid of the dye compared with what he or she can see with the aid of the dye can be enormous. And so the statistical significance is very strong even after the first surgery. So in those cases, you may only have to do 100 surgeries before you convince the FDA that this is absolutely important for the health of the American population.
I'm speaking with Dr. Phil Lau, the director of the Purdue Center for Drug Discovery. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of TechNation, BiotechNation, and TechNation Health are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show, Dr. Richard Kuhn, the first to discover the structure of the Zika virus and what that tells us. Stay with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tech Nation and a full show on Tech Nation Health. I'm speaking with Dr. Phil Lau, the director of the Purdue Center for Drug Discovery.
The difference between the lesions that the surgeon can see without the aid of the dye compared with what he or she can see with the aid of the dye can be enormous. And so the statistical significance is immediately very strong even after the first surgery. So in those cases, you may only have to do 100 surgeries before you convince the FDA that this is absolutely important for the health of the American population. But in cases like lung cancer, for example, and we're performing with our tumor-targeted fluorescent dyes surgeries on ovarian cancer, on lung cancer, on kidney cancer, on brain cancer, and so forth. So, but in lung cancer, the lesion may be a single lesion, and then what you're really looking for is that a maverick lesion, that secondary site that, if gone undetected, will almost certainly kill the patient. So it's very important to find any metastatic lesion there. But in many cases, there is no secondary site. It doesn't metastasize quite, at least early on, quite as widely as the ovarian cancer seems to do. So it depends on the particular cancer. And in some cases, we're not really looking to find malignant lesions in distant sites. Maybe in some tumors we'll be more interested in finding sentinel lymph nodes or the draining lymph nodes that have accumulated cancer cells. Or in other cases, for example, in breast cancer surgery, as I mentioned, up to 40% of those cancers recur at the site of the surgery, meaning they left disease tissue behind. What you really would like to do there is shave until the fluorescence is gone. You just continue to shave off. And because women are fond of their breasts, they don't want to have an extra large amount removed. But if you can just take enough to assure they will survive, that you've removed all of the disease and leave all the healthy tissue behind, then that benefits everybody.
Now, in surgery, of course, mm-hmm. you've opened up the human body and you're right there.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you detect the fluorescence from outside the human body?
Excellent question. I think as we develop improved contrast agents, these are the near infrared dyes. There are some that may be out in the far infrared or almost microwave region that can indeed be detected much deeper. To date, we've been able to detect malignant disease at depths up to 2.5 or more centimeters. In fact, I think one of the surgeons indicated they saw disease as deep as 4 centimeters. So we're getting closer to that objective, but we're not there yet. I'm sure in some cases that we're missing a lot of disease that is buried that deeply into the patient's tissue. But that's an objective, and I think the technology can be adapted to achieve that.
With metastasis, we're always worried about where are the cancer cells going.
Yeah.
When you inject these targeting agents, they're not just going to where you're operating. They're going all over your body.
Yeah, yeah.
Can we tell anything about metastasis from this?
Yes, I think the obstacle to that is, of course, getting the camera to the distant sites. What we have found is that the malignant lesions, regardless of where they are, light up, and they remain lit for a while. If I can just diverge onto a little story here, one of our surgeons at the University of Pennsylvania used our fluorescent tumor-targeted fluorescent dye to try to remove a brain tumor. Okay, and the state of the art is to do this endoscopically, and so he went up through the nose into the brain by that pathway and was able to remove most of the cancer. But because the tool that he had couldn't bend around a corner when going up through the nose and through the sinus cavities in the brain, he, in this particular case, had to remove the tools and tell the patient, we've got to go in through the skull and cut out a piece of the skull and go in and get what we missed, because they could still see fluorescence around the corner up in the cavity.
I got to get you. I can see you.
Yeah, uh-huh. So they did cut it out, but they had to wait 5 days to let the patient recover and from the original surgery up through the nose. And when they opened it up, the tumor was still brightly fluorescent. So even 5 days later, it still retained the tumor-targeted fluorescent dye. So I think that if you can get a camera in to the site nearby, you can even wait days and you can go back in and see the diseased tissue. The issue will be the technology for getting the cameras to the right place.
And, well, that's not good.
Well, I think in many cases you can
get
do
the
that.
Engineers after it.
Yeah. Or, again, as I said, you know, we can always hope that these new generations of contrast agents will allow a visualization of much deeper lesions. Yeah.
In the old days, we associated cancer with the part of the body we found it in. Yeah. You know, you're going after one cancer after another. Have you found that they're different or the same as you go to how we normally or typically classify cancer?
Oh, I think that all cancers are different. I think, indeed, I just returned from the American Association for Cancer Research National Meetings, and I mean, this isn't news, but it was reinforced at this meeting that even within a single patient, if you sequence the cancer cell's genome at one site in a solid tumor mass and then move over a centimeter away and sequence it at a different site, they're different cancers. They have mutated and developed different characteristics. And I think that brings up a very important point, Moira, and that is that in order really to be sure that one picks up all the malignant disease with a tumor-targeted fluorescent dye, I think it will be essential in the future to use a cocktail of dyes, because one may pick up tumor marker A and allow you to visualize, let's say, 60% of human cancers. Another will pick up tumor marker B and maybe it picks up 70% of human cancers. But to make sure there are no cancers that are missed by both A and B, you want component C in that cocktail that picks up the rest. And our feeling is right now that a cocktail of somewhere around 4 or so tumor-targeted fluorescent dyes will cover more than 90 to 95% of all human cancers and enable visualization of virtually all of them.
You got to find the neighborhood and clean it out.
That's right. You're exactly right. Yeah.
Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that, gee, if you can put dyes on these targeting modules, you could also put drugs on them. Yeah. You've worked on that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, we have now, I guess it is 7 targeted drugs in human clinical trials that are based on this same principle. Exactly as you said, if you can very specifically target a fluorescent dye to the cancer cells, you can also target a very nasty cytotoxic drug that will kill these cells. And so the regulatory hurdles in terms of passing the FDA for getting these much nastier drugs into humans is much more difficult, but we're moving forward with those, and we have, as I say, a number of these drugs in clinical development. I mean, they're not all nasty drugs. In one case, for example, we've learned to retarget immune cells, the killer T cells that are part of the immune system that are intrinsically capable of killing cancer cells if you can just teach them what the cancer cell looks like, where it is, tell it where it is. And so we are using our targeting molecules to target those T cells very specifically to the cancer cells too. We use these homing molecules for multiple applications.
Now, you're the chief science officer of about 5 companies. You've started, co-founded, if not founded, all these companies. You're still a dyed-in-the-wool professor. Yeah. But, you know, you're walking 2 sides of the street here, Phil.
Yeah.
How do you do that? How do you do that?
Well, I recognize what I believe I might do well, and then I also recognize what I know I don't do well, and I'm not good at business. And so what I have done is hired smart business people to run the business, and I try to relieve myself of all these business duties and focus my efforts on activities that I believe I do better than the business. And so I really spend 90% of my time in my lab at Purdue University and only 10% running around with the companies that I've started.
But sometimes they need new science or translational science or changes in approach.
Yeah.
Certainly that draws you back in.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a constant communication between the company and my lab at Purdue University. As a matter of fact, I fund a lot of the research in my lab from grants from my own companies. And then there's a relationship or an agreement with Purdue University where if the company funds the research, then they have first right of refusal for any patents that emerge from that that research. And, you know, I have, I don't know, over 60 patents that have come out of this kind of sponsored research in the last few years. And the companies have all benefited tremendously from these. In fact, almost all the technology in all of these companies originated. Now, it was all improved and optimized in the companies, but the original discoveries, almost all, in fact, I think all of them started in my lab.
Well, don't forget, we have the professor here who's doing all this research, and we've got companies doing all this business.
Yeah.
But we also have the FDA and in other countries, similar regulatory agencies. That in itself is really hard.
Oh, it is. It is definitely hard. And right now, I mean, one of our drugs, I didn't mention it, it's not related to cancer, but outside of the cancer arena, we have drugs moving through clinical trials in other areas, and one of those is malaria. And we're dealing right now with the Ministry of Health in Vietnam, where we're conducting clinical trials on this new therapy for malaria. And it's been, you know, they've been very helpful, but I must say it's been very difficult for quite a number of reasons. Not least of which is that the region where we're conducting the trials is right on the border with Laos and in Cambodia, where the drug-resistant strains of malaria are rampant, but at the same time where they have tribal villages that they don't like to let foreigners into. And so there's this, you know, contradiction here. How do you treat these patients with the drug-resistant forms of malaria if you can't get into the villages?
They're not glad to see you, and they ought to be.
Let me mention one more thing. I think one more advantage to this fluorescence-guided surgery that we haven't identified in our conversation yet, and that is that surgery of the future is going to be increasingly less invasive. In other words, surgeons are going to go in with endoscopes and laparoscopes and very small devices to try to invade the body with the least possible trauma, the smallest incision. This eliminates the opportunity for the surgeon to really see the malignant disease well and to feel it. In other words, you're not going to be sticking your hand into someone's brain any longer. And so this requires, to compensate for this loss of tactile and visual identification, new tools must be developed. And I think this is where the fluorescence-guided surgery using tumor-targeted fluorescent dyes will actually not only supplant what was used before, but actually improve on it.
Well, Phil, this has been terrific. You've got so much work to do. I can't believe you had time to come and see us. But please, anytime you can take a break and come and see us, we'd love to talk to you again.
Yeah. Well, it's my pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation too, Moira.
Dr. Phil Lau is a distinguished professor of chemistry at Purdue University and the director of the Purdue Center for Drug Discovery. He's also the chief scientific officer of Endocyte. More information is available at endocyte.com. That's E-N-D-O, endo, cyte, C-Y-T-E, endocyte.com. At this point, we're all pretty comfortable with DNA. It's a combination coming from mom and dad, and it's the program of who we are. Now that DNA somehow has to get read and translated into proteins. Dr. Richard Kuhn is a professor of biological sciences at Purdue University and director of the Purdue Institute for Inflammation, Immunology, and Infectious Disease.
Normally, but there are all kinds of caveats that we've found out in the last decade or two, but normally DNA and then it's encrypted in RNA, and that RNA then encodes for the building of proteins, which is, you know, what you see, basically.
Everything we are is a protein.
That's right. And those proteins carry out lots of chemical reactions, and they make us what we are.
Now, we're born with the DNA. Is the RNA, are we born with that too, or is that created on the spot?
So RNA is required for a number of very basic processes that the cell uses. So when we make proteins, there's machinery that the cell constructs, and that machinery is made up of both proteins and RNA. But the RNA is really the messenger, and we call it actually messenger RNA, for delivering the information that's stored very stable in DNA into the cell, and so that we can make proteins from that messenger RNA.
Sort of like you can load up your laptop or your cell phone or your tablet with an application, but if you don't punch it and get it to run, nothing's happening.
That's right. That's right. The RNA is kind of the intermediate between a very stable form of genetic information, DNA, and the building blocks that make the cell work. That's the protein.
Now, we're talking about viruses today. In fact, we're going to talk about RNA virus. What's that?
So RNA viruses have avoided the use of DNA. They have all of their genetic information stored within RNA itself. So it's much easier to go from the viral genome, the viral nucleic acid, you know, the genetic information of a virus, from RNA directly into protein.
Ah, so it says, well, we don't care what your DNA is. We're going to invade this RNA
yes.
and switch up the protein it's producing.
That's right. We're going to avoid the DNA world and everything associated with it. We're just going to take over that DNA world.
And what kind of viruses would be RNA viruses that we'd know?
So the very popular one that we've been talking about is Zika virus, for example. But poliovirus, the viruses that cause the common cold, flu. This is an RNA virus. HIV is an RNA virus. So lots of very common viruses that we're familiar with are actually RNA viruses.
In that HIV, they call that a retrovirus. Is that the same thing? That's different.
They call it a retrovirus because it has an unusual lifestyle. It actually is transported from cell to cell as an RNA virus in the RNA form. But when it gets into a cell, it infects the cell, it converts that RNA into DNA. And that DNA now looks just like the host. And in fact, what the retrovirus does is it inserts its DNA into the host genome. Okay? So you cannot then distinguish between the retrovirus genetic information and, for example, the human genetic information.
These viruses are very tricky.
They are very tricky indeed.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Zika because you were the first to discover the structure of the Zika virus. What did that take?
The hardest part was getting virus and then growing virus. It's not so easy to be able to grow this virus in large amounts, which was needed for our initial experiments. And so we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how could we grow the virus and produce it in very large quantities. Now, having said that, you know, this is a virus that can cause significant problems, especially in women who are pregnant. And so, you know, that was something that we had to be very careful about.
Now, if we go back to a famous structure that was decoded, such as DNA, Watson and Crick and Rosalind Franklin, we're talking about crystallography and pictures and things. We don't do that anymore, do we?
That certainly is used, but what we used to solve the structure of Zika virus is an emerging technique that's called cryo-electron microscopy. So you use an electron microscope and you flash freeze your samples. And there's a lot of pieces that actually go into it, so it's not as simple as I'm making out. But using advanced techniques that really have come in the last 2 or 3 years, we can now do exactly what people have done for 50 to 100 years with crystallography, and we can do it with a microscope now. And so we did it in a very fast pace because we had this capability of using this new instrument, this cryo-electron microscope. So we were able to actually determine the structure of the virus within really about 2 weeks or so.
And lots of people were trying to determine it.
That's right. So it was somewhat of a race. In 2016, I think everybody was really frantic with the emerging epidemic of Zika virus and trying to understand how this virus was causing the problems that we've heard about. And so every piece of information was really valuable to begin to really attack it in a sensible, rational way.
Any surprises in the Zika virus?
We had previously solved the structure of a very closely related virus called dengue virus. And dengue is a virus that infects hundreds of millions of people around the world every
year. Dengue fever.
Can lead to dengue fever, right. And so we had done that. And so Zika was very similar in structure. But those two viruses, although they look very similar, they act in very different ways. Zika is able to cross the placenta. It's able to infect neurons or developing neurons. Dengue does not do that. And so we really wanted to understand from the structure, which is the outside of the virus, you know, what features would allow that virus to get across the placenta and do the damage that it does.
Now, you're the director of the Purdue Institute for Inflammation, Immunology, and Infectious Disease.
Yeah. We call it Pi-4D, okay?
That sounds good, but I'm not coming over for lunch anytime soon in case you guys didn't clean up. You know, it's like, this sounds like a dangerous, very dangerous place to be. Where is studying the Zika virus within inflammation, immunology, and infectious disease?
Right. So we know it's an infectious disease. It's been spreading all over the Americas, and it will continue to spread. It'll probably spread to, you know, other continents. And so there's your infectious disease component. What's really important is how do we develop vaccines? And vaccines are going to be developing a set of antibodies that are going to control and prevent the disease. Okay, so that's your immunology component. And then, you know, when the virus infects the brain, there's inflammation that occurs because the virus is going in and it's killing certain types of cells. And that process results in inflammation.
It's almost like we now understand that all those pieces have to be together.
That's right. That's
so we
right.
might not have named it this 25 years ago.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's say you develop a Zika vaccine. This doesn't mean you're going around killing all the Zika virus in your system.
There are about 45 different vaccines that are being developed around the world right now. Of course, we need one really good one, although probably there'll be a few that actually hit the market. The idea behind the vaccine is to develop immunity, protection in an individual before they see the virus. And so that process is, you know, an antibody process where you are then protected against virus infection. And the bottom line for the vaccine is to prevent the disease. And so that's one strategy. The second strategy is, what if you already got infected with the virus? What can you do then? There, you can't rely on a vaccine. You have to rely on some kind of antiviral. And so there are many laboratories, companies that are now trying to develop antivirals that will control Zika virus once you're infected with it, especially if a woman who's pregnant is infected. And that adds another layer of complication. If you're just treating an adult with an antiviral, okay, those clinical trials are relatively straightforward. But now if you have to do a clinical trial in which you're trying to demonstrate that it's going to protect the fetus, that's another layer of complication.
Big complication.
That's a big complication.
Big complication. And it seems to me also that if you're protected because you didn't have the Zika virus, you almost don't care that the virus is coming at you. You're not going to get sick from it.
Yeah, that's an important point. But if you think about a population that many people get vaccinated, then the ability of mosquitoes to spread the virus or to pick up the virus and spread the virus is reduced significantly. So if we can get a large segment of the population vaccinated against Zika virus, the transmission rate by mosquitoes is going to drop significantly. And that's really another important component of vaccination and having lots of people get vaccinated. I should say that for poliovirus, just like for influenza virus, There is an incredibly good surveillance network around the world in which people are actively looking for cases of poliovirus. Because as you get down to, you know, 5 and 10 infections per year of poliovirus, you really want to make sure you count every one of them. And so the surveillance network for polio is exceedingly good around the world.
Now, you work on many different viruses in your lab. You work with many different people, scientists doing many different aspects of this. What do you need for a team? You're not all the same scientists, right?
Well, the team really needs to have a common goal. And our common goal is usually that we can control and eliminate disease and disease burden in the population. And so we all have that same goal. We want to get rid. We want to free the world of a polio in which children get paralyzed and some of them die. We want to get rid of that. That's a burden that the world doesn't need. We need to make sure that viruses like Zika can be controlled. We'd like to be able to control them in advance of an outbreak like we've seen for Zika virus. Zika has about 70 relatives, some of which we know about and some of which we even have vaccines for. But there's a whole bunch that are actually under the radar that no one works on because they don't cause human disease or the human disease is very mild. These are ones in particular that we have to be careful about because these viruses, they can change rapidly, they evolve rapidly, and we never know which one is going to change and begin causing disease.
Well, congratulations on being the first to discover the structure of the Zika virus, and hope you come back and see us again, Richard.
Oh, thank you very much, Moira.
Dr. Richard Kuhn is a professor of biological sciences at Purdue University and director of the Purdue Institute for Inflammation, Immunology, and Infectious Disease. For Tech Nation and for Tech Nation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment, Biotech Nation, are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcorn.